another edition of Expanding Mind. Your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. The longer I stay on this path of thinking, writing, reading, exploring, extending sensation, experience, consciousness, however you want to talk about it, from the inside, the more central music and listening has become to my practice, which is why, even though most of the time we talk about spirituality, psychedelics, technology, etc. on this show, I regularly like to include discussions with musicians, particularly musicians who can articulate on their practice richly and in with great inspiration for us. And one of the reasons for this is that I think one of the easiest ways into exploring the potentialities of experience is through music and listening. At least it's been true in my case. You can take your obsession over recordings, rock and roll, jazz, whatever, and ride those feelings until you can touch something deeper, more intense, maybe more opening. And that indeed listening has been a way into the spirit for many, many cultures and for many, many millennia, undoubtedly. Just the other night, I was watching a wonderful documentary, David Attenborough's first BBC documentary called The Tribal Eye, and it's an overview of tribal art, and remarkable, very worthwhile. It was shot in the early 70s, so there's a lot of stuff in there that doesn't exist anymore, well worth tracking down if you can get it. And in some of the episodes about Bali, they talk about the gamelan orchestra, and there were some remarkable things I learned there. One of them is the way in which they slightly detune the lower gongs from one another so that the warbling beat of the slightly off oscillating tones is very much part of the music. And what I love about that is that it points to the fact that music is a way of organizing pitches on the one hand, but it's also a physical object, a physical phenomena, if you will, in space. And that a lot of the we mix these two modes a lot, and we're often unaware of their differences. But that in the heart of even very traditional musics, in fact, perhaps more so than today, there is this attention to the physics of sound as well as the more sort of pitch orientation or the narrative or the associations or the cultural expressions of sound, and that difference can really be a remarkable entrance into a deeper way of being and experiencing this world. Another interesting thing from the documentary was the fact that each gamelan orchestra has its own way of tuning itself so that they're not mutually playable. You can't take a gong from one gamelan orchestra over here and take it over to the next village and play. They're each tuned to their own pitch universe, which means they're their own singular kinds of machines of explorations of the tonal universe. Really remarkable stuff. And these issues were stirred up as I thought and listened more deeply to the music of our guest today, Sarah Devachi. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Is a younger musician from Vancouver who's made some remarkable recordings that, and for me anyway, simultaneously open up the world of musical expression, of emotional qualities, of deep richness of feeling, while also drawing tremendously acute and detailed attention to these sort of micro gestures of sound itself. And it's a very haunting experience. She's a drone musician, you might say, ambient artist, but working with a degree of finesse and attention that draws forth from the listener and a kind of, at least in my experience, a sort of equivalent degree of attention, and therefore making the music not just pleasant or supportive to listen to, intriguing, enigmatic even, but also really a kind of avenue towards a different way of listening, a kind of attention to detail that can become a portal into a more general way of being in the world. Again, in my experience, but it's my show, so I get to talk to who I want to. So with no further ado, Sarah, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So we'll talk about your new record in a little bit, but you've mostly been known for your earlier recordings that use a lot of analog synthesizers, of classic, even antiquated, if very charismatic, instruments. I'd like to talk more about your relationship with these instruments, since probably the easiest place to begin is where you began. Where did you first sort of encounter electronic instruments, and how did they draw you away from the more traditional classical training that you came from?
Yeah, well, I first got into them in kind of a weird way. Like, it was, I think it was pretty abnormal for most people, that I didn't really know anything about them, didn't have an interest, whatever, until I got this job at this musical instrument museum up in Canada. And it was just kind of, I was like thrown into it. Like, I had, you know, keys, and I was giving tours, and I had basically, you know, unfettered access to all of these instruments that I had never heard of, never seen before. So whereas most people, I think, like, read about these instruments and develop some sort of like interest in them from a distance and then seek them out, I had them in front of me and I was looking at them and using them and then going home and being like, okay, what was that thing that I just played? And learning about them that way. Yeah, so that had like a huge impact on me. And working there, you know, you meet people and you make connections to people who are in that world, and it just kind of opens up more and more opportunity to access those kinds of instruments and that type of equipment. Yeah, so that was like the starting point. And I think when I was playing, I was classically trained in piano, and when I was sort of nearing the end of what I did, or when I did it like sort of rigorously, when I was kind of in my late teens, I started to become interested in like wanting to make music and sort of make my own sounds. But the piano didn't feel right to me. And so I didn't really, you know, follow through because I didn't feel like I wanted to do anything with the piano, and that was all I knew. So when I found these instruments, it was just like a wealth of, it was kind of liberating in a way that it was all these ways of working with sound and sort of extending sound and manipulating sound in the ways that I was interested in and what I wanted to hear that I didn't even think was like possible before, just limiting myself to the piano.
Well, given the range of, extraordinary range of digital instruments today, what was it about these older analog devices, or what is it about analog as a kind of mode of creating electronic sound that that attracts you, that allows you to do what you wanted to do, to explore the sound worlds that were calling to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a number of reasons, I think, but initially it was, I would say, first just the sound quality was, for me anyway, noticeably different. Everybody kind of has this view that analog sounds warmer and it sounds different than digital, and I felt that to be true with the instruments anyway, that I noticed that the sound was just richer with the analog, with the older especially analog instruments. And at the time, I didn't really know why that was the case. But I've sort of, at least for what I do, the way that I use instruments, I found that because they're construction-wise, in terms of components and just their age, they're old technology. Because of that, they're very unstable. In terms of modern expectations, they drift a lot, especially the oscillators are not, you could try to get them in tune, even on instruments that were meant to stay in tune at the time, like a lot of the Moog and the Arp instruments kind of were marketed as being more stable than their competitors. But even those, instruments from the 70s are not, they're not stable at all. You'll set different oscillators in tune with each other, and they'll drift in and out of each other. And the more I looked into that phenomenon, I discovered that it had to do with psychoacoustics and the way that frequencies interact with one another when they're sort of bumping around in close proximity. And it's not just those frequencies that are moving that you hear. It's the differences between them and the combination of them and different things like that that start to create this sort of lush quality that you get with not only with analog instruments but also with acoustic instruments. And that's something that more lately, like in the last couple of years, that's really become more of a conceptual thing for me, is this notion that analog synthesizers, for me, they have so much in common with acoustic instruments, partly in that they're, like I say, unstable. Like acoustic instruments are played by humans, so of course they're unstable. Well, they're played and constructed by humans also. But yeah, the analog instruments, to me, they feel different. Like when you're playing them, it feels like you're playing an instrument. They're heavy, they incorporate wood, they oftentimes, they have physical things inside them, like reverb tanks or springs or things like that, like actual physical things that produce these sounds that can be affected, if you go into a warm room or a cold room or there are lights or whatever. The instruments, just like acoustic instruments, can be affected by those things. So for me, yeah, it's just an extension of what attracts me still to acoustic instruments, which is their physicality.
Yeah, I mean, I hear a lot about embodiment in what you're talking about, that the body is very much part of listening, part of awareness, and part of musical possibility. And I think that's a really interesting thing to reflect on now, when the way people listen and make music has changed so dramatically, just even in the last 20 years. That you can't, I think you can fairly ascribe, some of that changes to increasing disembodiment, both in terms of how music is made. You're not really dealing with a three-dimensional object that's resonating. You're manipulating symbols and time, and that can be wonderful. But also the way that it's consumed. People listening to little headbuds and sort of going through these vast archive libraries where that sort of make music more like a sign, more like music is more like data and less like a sort of physical event in the world. I mean, there's different ways to talk about that. And anytime you start talking about this kind of stuff, this leads to my next question, is there's this sort of issue of nostalgia, that sometimes people go, oh, that you're just sort of like, you're indulging in nostalgia. This is now these new tools, this new sensibility is what we need to explore. But I'd like to, to hear you talk about nostalgia, because it for me, it's a dimension of these instruments. I love analog synthesizers, and I collect a lot of the recordings. And though I'm not a music maker myself with synthesizers, I know a lot about them, and I have friends who use them. And I know that there's something about nostalgia for me, but I think that sometimes we blanket or block out the conversation about nostalgia, and we don't go into it and really look at what it is that we're talking about when we say nostalgia. I think there's something more than just, oh, I like those records when I like the 70s or something like that. So I'd love to hear how you feel about that.
Yeah, I mean, I try not to think of it in terms of nostalgia. Like, I don't, I mean, I approach it from different points of view, I guess. Like, I, as a music maker, I try to separate myself from it. But as, you know, from like an historical kind of, or like a, you know, music appreciator kind of person, there's a part of it for sure that's like, you know, connected with these instruments being part of a world that's not here anymore. You know, it's the same thing with early music instruments, that there's something, you know, there's the instruments on their own, which they could have been made today and they would be just as like radical and just as interesting acoustically and sonically. But there's something else that puts them in the context of where they came from, like the environment that they grew out of, and you know, what was on the minds of the people who were making them at the time. That's so interesting, I think. So I appreciate them in that respect, you know, historically, like in their context, cultural context. But in terms of why I play them, you know, it's, for me, it has nothing to do with nostalgia necessarily. You know, it's like I say, a big part of the stuff that I just mentioned, like the acoustic stuff, the way that they behave. But the way that I work, like, I don't, you know, I use a lot of hardware and I use a lot of those instruments for those reasons, but I'm not like exclusive to it at all. And when I work, especially on records, for me, it's like in tandem, you know, analog technology and digital technology. Like, I do a lot of the recording, and a lot of the sound sources come from analog or acoustic sources. But when I'm actually working on music, when I'm like composing it, it's all digital. It happens, you know, I use Logic, I use digital signal processing. It all happens digitally. And I think, you know, I use it to the effect that I think benefits the sound at the end of the day. You know, like, I kind of have that view that whatever you have to do to favor how it sounds is okay. You know, I mean, it justifies the means to the end.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's not about locking you in an analog box.
I would never. if you can do something that's going to make the music sound better, make the sound more interesting or whatever, then of course, why wouldn't you, you know, why would you limit yourself just on a principle of like, well, I don't want to use a computer or whatever. Like, I think that mentality is kind of, I don't subscribe to that. You know?
Yeah. That seems like a kind of needless fetish. But I do think that part of what people mean when they talk about the nostalgia isn't just a memory of the historical time. This is just my opinion. You might think, you know, whatever, but is that there's something about the physicality of, or the let's call it organic physicality, the warmth that people ascribe to analog instruments is almost like it stirs something within us. It stirs some kind of set of associations, and almost maybe on an unconscious level or psychoacoustic level, that reminds us or draws us into networks of association with embodiment, with nature, with flows, with rhythms, with reverberations, with resonances, with textures, with this sort of world that in some ways, especially if we're living, you know, hyper postmodern lives of data flow and cubicle farms and, you know, information processing and da-da-da, that just that whole world of embodiment can be something to feel nostalgic about.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I say, like, in the way that they're kind of like acoustic instruments, you know, they're objects, like they're finite objects, which a computer is, as a musical instrument, is not. You know, you can, it's near limitless. You can do so many different things with it. And I feel like actual hardware instruments are different in that sense, in that they're, You hear a lot of people who play these kinds of instruments and become sort of attached to them, almost referring to their instruments as like, it sounds maybe weird to say, but almost as like beings. There's a bit of this like emotional connection to them. And it's true, they're almost like people in a way. They have, they take up space, but they have limits. You get to know them and you get to know what they can do and what they can't do and who they are and who they're not. And you sort of appreciate them on their own as opposed to being like, okay, now I'm going to wipe you and create something completely different. They're finite in that sense, as I say. They're sort of like permanent only, if that makes sense.
That makes sense. There's a quality, there's a liveliness to their object quality, and that's something that I pick up even in your music, in the sense that and it is I you know we'll play a sample from your new record in a little while, and it's sort of funny to talk about this music when we're not going to play it, but it doesn't really lend itself to like quick sampling. It's really a kind of invitation to move into a space. But one of the things about it that sets it apart from a lot of ambient and drone music that I've listened to anyway, is that there's I very much sense a kind of invitation to appreciate very fine-grained texture, slight shifts in emphasis or overtones coming in and out, that reminds me, not quite of looking at it through a microscope, that sounds too clinical, but let's say when you're really appreciating the quality of a fabric or of some kind of almost a textural sense. So there's very much a sensory invitation in there, not just an emotional kind of cosmic awe feeling that a lot of stuff creates, but there's really almost a tactile quality to it.
That's interesting, yeah, that you say that, because I've been noticing that I look at things like that a lot, and maybe that's not like, I kind of have to remind myself that maybe not everybody looks at objects or, appreciates objects specifically in that way. And I remember early on when I was trying to like figure out what kind of or how to like describe the music that I wanted to make just to myself. I remember thinking, I would listen to all this classical music. When I was again sort of at the age of getting ready to like quit piano, taking piano seriously. I was obsessing over Chopin. I was really into his music, and it was so much of it is just the he'll pause on certain chords or intervals or a cadence or something. Certain tones that he's very aware of how they sound, And I remember hearing them and I would think like, oh, I wish I could just hear that chord for like 5 minutes. I wish I could just listen to that, And in so much classical music and popular music, we have all these beautiful sounds, but they don't last. We don't get to hear them and we don't get to actually investigate them in that sort of way. We hear them and then they move to the next note or they move to the next thing and everything happens so quickly. And so that's kind of what I became interested in doing, is taking these sort of like moments of sound and extending them so that you can actually hear, not just appreciate the sound on its own, but hear what's happening in the sound itself. It's like when you look at like a you look at a painting and you notice a color that you really like. It's really beautiful. And it's so small, it takes up such a small portion of the painting. And then you look at like a minimalist painting, and it's maybe that square of color that's exploded like, 50 times the size. So you can actually appreciate that color for itself, but you can see intricacies within it when you sort of step back and look at it, as you say, a bit under a microscope kind of. I think you hit the nail on the head there.
It's funny. I was listening to the radio in my car a week or so ago, and they played the Beatles' "Day in the Life," and then it came to that final chord, And I was, you know, and then I'm sitting there going, well, how long are they going to let this go? And it was clearly they weren't going to go on to the next track. Like they were actually going to let it like hang in radio, on radio land, you know, where like silence is the most horrible thing imaginable. Yeah. And they kept it all the way to the end.
Wow, that's amazing.
You know, it was great. And well, maybe think of something for you is like, you know, you perform live and, you know, you've had to kind of retool some of your work to be able to do it live. But that must be a difficult thing to do, to ask an audience, even an audience who's chosen to come see you play, that, you know, like, okay, we're going to slow it down here for a while. And there must be that some kind of like this weird sense of restlessness, or it must be difficult from a performer point of view sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. And that, I think the more I play, the more that becomes a thing, you know, like, it really depends on, I find, on the venue more so than the audience. I feel like you can have, you know, an audience that, like the venue sets the mood, you know, it doesn't really matter who's there. And I find that, you know, when I play at like bars or clubs or somewhere where the mood is a bit more energetic, or, you know, maybe there's a band playing or a DJ or something like that, those are the difficult ones, because people, you know, they're standing around, they're drinking, they're socializing. Nobody's listening. You know, they just want to stand there and, like, you know, move their head around to a beat or something. And I don't give them that. And that's when it becomes hard. And it, you know, you have to kind of, I don't really change what I do that much, but I try to keep it moving a little bit more than I would. And it's just a less enjoyable experience, because I'm, you know, maybe, I don't know if everybody who makes music or performs music feels this way, but when I play, I'm listening also, you know, like I'm kind of enjoying it also when I'm listening. And so it's unpleasant for that reason too, that for me, it's like, oh, that was rushed, or, oh, I can't really hear that because there's just people talking, you know, they're ruining my listening experience also. But on the flip side, you know, when you get a really nice space and an audience that's willing, that's there to listen, you know, not to socialize, then it's incredible. You can, you know, especially at like the end of a set, when you've sort of given people something to like chew on, and then you can just let a sound decay for like 5 minutes, and people, till the last, you know, last little bit that they can hear, people are actually listening. It's amazing. It's really nice, a nice feeling to have that. Very different experience though.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw Dudamel conduct Mahler's Ninth here in San Francisco a couple of months ago, and it finished, the last sound faded, and he held it for like 30 seconds before like making the sign for everyone. So it wasn't even just the decay of the sound, it was actually the silence following the sound. And in a way, it was kind of a bravura move, but it was still very impressive, because there's something that happens like when you're in a hall, and it's one of the reasons I actually go out to see classical music more than a lot of other kinds of music. Not that I listen to it at home I listen to mostly other things, is because there's something about, even though there's, you know, problematic class aspects to it, blah blah blah, there's something about the fact that everybody's coming together and agreeing to just sit and really try to listen that makes the whole hall like kind of, you know, hum in this way. There's something about people's attentions being focused that is really powerful. And I think you sound like a school marm when you go, I can't popular music be more like that. But that's not what I mean. Because those resources are there, and those listeners are there, and those musicians are there. But it does seem sometimes that we're missing a lot of golden opportunities because of the way that music is made and consumed these days.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been thinking about that lately too, actually, that I feel like maybe in a weird way, I mean, I kind of rejected, when I was playing piano, that was kind of the thing that really turned me off, you know, to not want to take it more seriously, was the performing aspect, because I hated the pressure of, like, you know, the perfect performance, which any classical musician, you know, that kind of, that's an overwhelming thing. But I feel like maybe I've been spoiled in a sense that I've, you know, played so many recitals and concerts, piano concerts and things like that when I was in my teens that I got used to this notion that people are going to sit and listen to you play almost to a detriment. You know, they're listening so closely, like, is she going to make a mistake? Was that the right note? Did she play that with enough tone or, you know, whatever? But in a good way, it's maybe spoiled me to expect that people are going to listen and that, you know, even at the end, like you're trained to such a micro level when you're playing classical music, you know, that there is that aspect of like you end the piece and you even if you play piano, you know, you move your hands away from the piano, you put them on your lap and you wait a few seconds before you make another movement to indicate that the piece is complete. You know, there's that element of silence framing things. That I think is so nice and that all music should have. Maybe not all music, but more music than currently.
Well, you talk about listening and when you're performing, how you're also a listener. But I also hear that in the music as well, that there's, I mean, obviously everyone who's composing, you know, is listening to what they're doing, but that there's a pleasure in it or a kind of, I guess I would say an active passivity or something like that, where you're like open to what's going to happen here, but not necessarily trying to control it, that there's a quality of kind of appreciation there. I'd like to hear you talk more about listening, whether it's your own music or other things, because it seems to me one of the, you know, characteristics of your music is, again, an invitation to a somewhat different kind of listening.
Yeah, I mean, I hear things in all the music that I listen to that I have to remind myself sometimes that's not what people are listening to. And that's fine. You know, people can appreciate different things, of course. But I just, to me, sometimes things are so obvious. And I'm like, why can't you hear that, you know, to other people? And I think one thing that people, when they get to know me, what they find surprising is that I guess you could say I have a very eclectic taste. And a lot of the music that I hold like most dear actually is not necessarily experimental. It's popular music from the 70s because the production to me is so overwhelming and so mind-blowing. And when I listen to it, you know, I love the music, I, you know, for its musical qualities. But when I listened to it, you know, everything about it, that was, for me, that was like the height of like this sort of, you know, having this facade of like, it's just popular music and here's the beat and here's a melody and here's some lyrics that you can relate to, whatever, all that stuff that people initially love about music. But it's like it's like an iceberg, you know, you see that top, but then you don't see all the stuff below it in the background. And that's the stuff that I find so fascinating about that era, is all this attention to tone and detail that has such an impact on the music, but that is never really talked about that much in that kind of music. Like, you know, even going down to like the micro details of like the console that it was recorded on, you know, you think of like Helios consoles as being part of this era where the technology shaped the sound, you know, where the EQ of the console had an effect on the sound. That's why that, you know, music that was recorded on a Helios console sounds the way that it does. It's not just, you know, Keith Richards' guitar or whatever. It's the stuff that you don't even think about. Or even like the speakers, you know, that it was mixed on or mastered or whatever. You know, all of these little things play into it, and I find that so inspiring and so enjoyable for me to listen to. When I listen to it, I'm thinking about that kind of stuff.
It's a wonderful thing to develop too, because there's a lot of pluses to it. One is that it allows you to continue to love those recordings that maybe you first loved when you were younger, and to bring your like expanding and attention and knowledge and taste to that experience. I'm really fascinated by that whole sort of I guess, I don't know what you call it, a culture of people who, like, you know, break down the tracks of well-loved, you know, rock and roll recordings and just completely fetishize, like, this, yeah. the bass sound or whatever. So they want to just hear the individual instruments. And at first, when I became aware of how intensely people got into that, I was a little puzzled. I was like, it's like they want their recording so much that they have to, like, chop it up into little bits. And then I went, no, that's not it at all. It's actually a way to sneak into the kind of appreciation you're talking about, where the fine grained details magnify the pleasure that you've already taken in the song in a more conventional sense.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I also, the more I I guess the more that I do what I do, I've become a lot more interested in just instruments on their own. You know, for my professional life and partly from making music, aside from all of the technology and everything behind it, everything that happens in the studio and all of that, I find myself becoming more and more fascinated just with the instruments on their own. And, you know, even like having learned about how a piano is built and how pianos are regulated or whatever, you know, differences between different manufacturers, I can hear a piano differently now, and I appreciate different things about its sound and about its tone. And that I find is a bit more of a visceral thing also, because you can, you know, you don't have to go like read about it necessarily to be able to appreciate that, you know, you hear a harpsichord and it sounds amazing. And even if you don't know why, you can understand something about it, you know, about its sound and its effect.
Yeah, and that love is clearly evident on your new record, All My Circles Run.
Thank you.
Which I think it's your fourth full length, and what's different about this record, you let the analog synthesizers have a rest. They're in the corner.
Need a break.
They need a break, and so you turn towards more traditional instruments: piano, strings, even the voice, organ. And so that, you know, that must have been quite an interesting moment, because you're like, you know, there's so much more, even more history, more associations, more concepts that are layered on top of these, you know, a violin or a viola or what, I don't know what's the string instrument you use, but that, and so how did you kind of bring your particular voice, your sense of what you want to do with your music to these instruments?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it kind of felt just like a natural thing. I mean, I think like stylistically and formally, it's nothing really different necessarily. It's something like radically different from what I've been doing previously. But I think it, you know, from the beginning, like I say, it was really, you know, I think a lot of people, again, who kind of come from this staunch classical tradition, if they come out of it, they find that there's almost like a bit of trauma that they have to like deal with, you know, just from like the how like rigorous a practice it is. And I think it took me a few years anyway to be like comfortable to go back to acoustic instruments, you know, like the synthesizer. When I found it, like I say, it was such a liberating thing. And then it was just later on, you know, like maybe a few years ago, where I was like, you know, I could use acoustic instruments. I don't have to do piano the way that I was doing it when I was younger. I can use a piano and actually make the music that I want to make. And, you know, I'd been using a lot of other acoustic instruments from the beginning also. I'm really fascinated by string instruments and organs and things like that, because I find that they have sort of a mutual acoustic identity with the analog synthesizers also. So, yeah, for me, it was just, it's the same way of making music. It's just a different source.
That makes sense. So, well, with that, I want to play just a painfully short, I think the track itself is almost 10 minutes, but we'll just hear 30 seconds or so of the piece For Voice. So play it, engineer. Thank you. Again, just a painfully brief sample, and of course, it just makes me want to hear it on over better, higher bit rate and better speakers. But that piece really kind of, I mean, I love all the pieces on the new record, but that one I found interesting in that you really allowed yourself to go lush and angelic, and you know, it you didn't feel the need to be overly dry. It's like I could hear it reverberating in a cathedral. I mean, it was like you were going for that kind of sound. I just was curious about that particular, the sort of lushness you allowed in that piece.
Yeah, well, that one's an interesting one because that one of all of them probably had the most like planning behind it, like in a direct way and an indirect way. Also, the first time I got an idea to do that kind of piece, I was in Berlin like probably 5 or 6 years ago, and I was just walking down the street one day, and I walked past this church, and I saw a sign for like an organ, or sorry, not an organ, like a choral competition, you know, like all these different choirs in Berlin. And so I went in, and it turned out to be like this full day thing. And there was like minimal changeover between the choirs. It was just basically just like going into a church, and you could sit there all day and just listen to people singing the choral music. And it was amazing. I probably spent like all afternoon there just listening to it. And so that was the first, like, I just want to write, you know, really like, you know, drony vocal choral music and deal with the counterpoint and all of that goes into it. And I've always been interested in church spaces and that sort of the way that music was presented, you know, during sacred, when sacred music was a bit more of a standard thing. This idea that, you know, the voice is like an extension of a deity voice, you know, that it goes through the church, and the church is built to reverberate so that it's meant to sound like it's everywhere, you know. Anyway, so when I got the idea to do, you know, sort of this whole acoustic record, I was like, well, I should, you know, incorporate that idea of doing that choral piece. And that was the first one that I worked on. That was the first one I recorded. And it was because I'd never done anything that was like that. I enlisted a soprano in Vancouver, this woman, Camille Hesketh, who's amazing. She does early music and new music. And, you know, we met a few times and talked about different types of you know, sounds and different vowels and things like that that would, when layered, try to accentuate overtones and things like that. And yeah, that piece had the most planning and the most preparation and took the longest to record. And it was probably the one that I worked on the most. And I, you know, usually when I do my compositions, it's like I say, it's just kind of digital. It happens in Logic, and then it's kind of done. This one I did a few different versions where I, you know, I made the piece and then I played it through my speakers at home and recorded it and then did it a few times to kind of remove it from, make it a little bit less present or a little bit more, you know, having it be recorded in a room. Yeah, so it's good that you can hear that.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about the spaces, because it seems to me that one of the ways into this way of listening that we've been kind of talking about without exactly naming that about your music, but also listening to other kinds of music, that one of the ways into that kind of listening is to really meditate on, appreciate, open up, and recognize the relationship between sound and space. That sound and space, both literally, like sound is happening in a space, that space determines the sound. You know, when you were recording, when you were talking about all the wonderful qualities of 70s recordings, I was also thinking about just the whole tradition of microphone placement and the way that mics can capture the sound and the space of rooms, and how you can hear different kinds of rooms and different sorts of recordings, and the way that space gets folded into the sound as an object. But it also seems to point to something real, like much deeper. That I think one of the reasons that people respond to people who are into it respond to ambient music or drone music or thus very slow music is because it allows the spatial quality to become more present, and that is a very rich dimension of sound. So I can only have you play. What's the most interesting space you've played in?
good question. I'm sure there's a few others from the past that I'm forgetting. But more recently, I did like a little tour in Europe last fall, and I played these two shows that were in these really weird spaces. One of them in London, this is probably the most interesting space I've ever played in. It's like an underground pit, like a circular concrete pit. It's large, and it fits like maybe 100, 200 people or something. But it's just, a concrete underground thing that it was initially built when they first started building the tube, the trains, underground trains. That was where they first started. They dug this hole, and then they started building the train. And then when they finished, they just had this hole in the ground, and they turned it into a museum. It's called the Brunel Museum after the civil engineer who designed the tube system, I think. And then in the last couple of years, they've opened up this space for like special events. I was told that, like 6 months before my show, they just built a staircase to go down there. Previously there was just like a hole at the top that you had to like put a ladder down to get in there. So that was incredible. And they somehow managed to get a grand piano down there. So when I played there, I had synthesizer and then piano, in this crazy circular reverberant space. It was really interesting. And then, so sonically that was kind of interesting. And then the other show that I played on that tour was in Berlin. I played at this boathouse, I guess. I don't know. It's like this weird, it was like a U-shaped building. It had like two areas on the side, and then in the middle is where you'd park your boat, but it was right on the river, and it was interesting sonically also, but it was more just interesting as like for its vibe, because it was dark by the time we were playing, and you had like the sound of the water and the sound of the boat kind of moving and the water hitting the building, which was really a nice like counterpoint to the sort of like gentle music. But then you also had all these boats and things like that that were passing by very slowly because it's a river, they're not really moving fast. And their lights would pass through, and it was just really interesting as a space. And I feel like, I'm obviously more interested in sound, but also just the feeling of a space can affect things also. When there isn't a bar, like an active bar, that alone makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I can imagine. When you were saying that earlier,
as long as there isn't a bar, it's
no bar. Yeah, I saw Low once in a bar, and it was just a nightmare. It was just really depressing.
I mean, some bars are like some venues that are more like institutionalized that are meant to, they're venues, but they serve, whatever drinks. That's a slightly different thing because they at least appreciate, you get your drink before and then you sit down and you listen, and they maybe, you don't get up while people are playing and stuff like that. I can deal with that. I've played in a lot of churches also over the years. I have sort of my big goal for touring anyway is to try to do a tour of Europe that's just playing in churches and like cathedrals and things like that. I play organ also, so it'd be fun to just come up with like a set for pipe organ and just tour it through churches in Europe one day.
Yeah, that would be remarkable.
Churches are nice. Yeah, that would be awful. It would be so unpleasant. but churches are kind of the nice space. Every time I've played, and when. I mean, they're nice, like they have a nice feeling and they always sound nice, but sometimes I find they're a little bit deceptive because they do weird things with the sound. Like they're not, at least the churches that I've played in are not necessarily acoustically built for like all types of music. They're very well suited for speech, obviously. And then, like vocal, like sermons and hymns and things like that, right? So music where words are meant to be clearer. And so I find sometimes it doesn't sound bad, but I find when I play in churches, sometimes they do weird things or it sounds different in unexpected ways. And it's just kind of weird in that way, but it's not a bad thing necessarily.
One of the things I noticed when you were talking about the places you had played, particularly on the boat, is that even though your music is very, is relatively quiet and certainly invites close listening, is that you don't seem to mind the idea that there's some kinds of sounds that would leak in, that you're not super hermetic about the sound sources. Is that true of your recording practices as well? Like, are you like, ah, there's a buzz, or like, ah, there's a kid crying down the hall. Big deal, like, I'll just.
I mean, it kind of depends. It's more like a case by case basis. Like, if I was recording and something happened, it would my response would either be like, "Oh, I didn't like that," or, "Oh, that could work. Let's leave it." Like on the record, on All My Circles Run, on the very last piece for piano, when I was recording one of the piano overdubs towards the end, I was recording in sort of a like a performance space in downtown Calgary, and it was right onto a sort of a major street. And so at one point, when it gets quiet, you can hear cars driving by. And I remember hearing that later on. I did, for some reason, I didn't notice it when I was recording, but I listened to it later on. And at first, it was kind of like, oh, I can't go back and record that. It's too much work. But then the more I listened to it, I was like, oh, it's not bad actually. It places it, and it's almost like in that context, I feel like it kind of works a little bit because when it comes in, it's in a bit of like a almost like a reprieve kind of feeling. So I don't know. It's case by case, but I wouldn't, there's certain sounds like a baby crying. I think I would never be okay with. Just aesthetically, I don't think that's a sound I would ever really want to embrace. But yeah,
Understandable.
it depends on certain things. Like even artifacts of certain things, like when there's a hum in the instrument or whatever, sometimes that can be sort of charming,
It's funny. I've listened to and kind of studied just anthropologically a lot of New Age music. And one of the things that interests me about is all the different uses that people make of it. Like, it's not just, for listening, or this kind of listening, or that kind of listening. It's for healing, it's for supporting, it's for, and including like all these like crazy ideas of, astral vibrations and all this stuff. But there's this weird way in which the pleasures of the music are connected to a certain idea of functionality. And I say that as a preface to the question. Have people talk to you, since your music is available in that way, for people who listen for different reasons, maybe than a typical electronic music fan or Muso Wire magazine reader? Have you had that? Have you had listeners come and kind of like talk about the way that your music has sort of entered into their lives, like in ways that you would not even would you not have anticipated from a more kind of compositional point of view?
I mean, I've had people, it ranges from like basic, like your music helps me fall asleep to like, more like, oh, I have anxiety and listening to your music kind of helps sort of thing. I don't, like the whole like music therapy and that sort of thing, I think it's a noble pursuit, obviously, but it's not something I would ever want to pursue myself. I think I'm a little bit too selfish in terms of music that for me, it's still just like about the pleasure of like listening for the sake of listening because I like how it sounds, not because it serves any sort of purpose. But in the same breath that I say that, I think I also, I view a lot of musical ideas from like popular music and classical music, whatever, as being more like functions, you know, like melody and harmony for me are using sounds to some effect, you know. And like I say, with what I try to do, I'm kind of trying to, for lack of a better word, liberate the sound and remove it from having this function of like, you know, the D is going to serve as the dominant or whatever, you know, like I don't think of it necessarily in that terms where I'm like, let's just hear what this texture is like, or what this frequency, or if we put these two frequencies together, if we listen to that fifth interval, what does that sound like, as opposed to the fifth resolving to this or something, you know, like, I think it's just based on the context, I guess. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, no, it totally makes sense. I mean, but I think that there's tremendous value that's not necessarily, maybe explicitly in terms of healing or whatever healing means exactly, but that just the practice of listening to your music or other music that pays attention to precisely what you just described, the way that the sound is liberated from its sort of function as part of a strictly musical organization, and becomes an event in physics in your immediate consciousness that you have a relationship with. That process, I think, is tremendously valuable, not just for healing, but for, frankly, keeping yourself sane and interested in the world, which can be a very difficult place.
Absolutely, yeah, I would agree.
But that skill, I mean, that's something that's not just about music; it's about how you move through space.
Yeah, well, people, I think the reason why, maybe one of the reasons why this music is a little bit, this kind of music is difficult for people is because I think people are kind of impatient. You know, like they don't know how to listen. They don't know how to just sit with something and really listen to it. You know, it's why I think popular music thrives, is because you can, you know, you can hum along to it, you can sing along to it, you can tap your foot, you can, you know, all these sorts of things. You can put it on in the background when you're hanging out with people. It's a social thing. You know, it serves all of these other functions beyond just straight up listening. And I think when people are forced to actually listen to something and they don't have something else to distract them with, you know, something to look at or something to whatever, you know, relate to in like a physical way, it's a bit disconcerting for people. So I think, if anything, this kind of music helps people, yeah, maybe become more aware of that and sort of like mellow out a little bit.
Well, we're gonna have to end it there, Sarah. Thanks so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So Sarah's new record is All My Circles Run, and all her recordings are highly worthwhile. And you can check her more out about her on her website.